Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Supernatural George. I'm Mittens, and today we are going to be talking about Season 6, Episode 1, Exile on Main Street, written by Sarah Gamble and directed by Phil Segretia. Welcome to Season 6. Here we go. I am fully aware that this season ranks near the bottom of a lot of people's season ranking lists. Maybe not the absolute bottom, but close to it for a lot of folks. But I intend to power through and find every last redeeming bright spot in the entire season. Because weirdly, there's also a pretty decent number of individual episodes that rank very high on people's favorite lists. From The French Mistake to The Man Who Would Be King, there's definitely some low points and incredibly forgettable episodes too, including the one episode I never remembered even existed until it came around on the rewatch again, through my first half a dozen or so loops through the series, only by just repeatedly hammering the darn thing into my brain do I even remember it exists at all. All Dogs Go to Heaven, I only remember it against my will now. But we've got a ways to go before we get to that one. Let's start at the beginning. 1 year after the events of Swan Song, Dean is, according to the title and the Rolling Stones, exiled on Main Street. He's our beautiful loser, thanks Bob Seger. And the early part of the season definitely bears that out. This season is intensely set in Dean's point of view. Since that first chunk of the season is trying to keep the secret of what's wrong with Sam, because something is definitely very, very wrong with him. The audience only have what Dean knows about Sam, with maybe a few extra little glimpses, but they keep it very tightly on Dean. I'll have plenty of time to vent all my feelings about it as we go through this episode, but suffice to say that I have always been a Dean girl. And this season sent my Dean girlism into nuclear mode. So be ready for that to rear its beautiful ugly head. I guess this season of the podcast will be my thesis on Dean Stanism, I guess. We'll see. We'll see how this goes. Unfortunately, we don't get to find out what's up with Cass for another 2 episodes. So talking about season 6 as a whole here for a moment, it sort of makes what they end up doing to Cass by the end of the season just that much worse, that he's not even introduced as a primary factor in the season right from the first episode, even though he is a main cast this season. He was brought on as a season regular for the first time this season instead of just being, you know, a guest star. It's almost like, well, we'll do that because we're going to kill him at the end of the season, so, or at the beginning of season 7, which they knew a plan for by late season 6 anyway. So that just sucks. I've got a bunch of interviews with Sarah Gamble and Fred Lane, who plays Azazel again, and the usual assortment of links for y'all to check out about this one. So without wasting any more time, I think we should just get right into talking about it, because like all season premieres, it sets up the entire season, so there's probably going to be a lot to talk about. Unlike most other seasons, we don't begin with a The Road So Far segment. We begin with 1 year ago, as if one full year has passed, even though in the timeline, Sam went into the cage in May of 2010, and now it's supposed to be October of 2010. So that's like 5 months. So they keep talking about a year, but it was really about 5 months. So this a whole year, it's like, well, canonically, it's like 5 months, which feels like a lot of a year, but is still less than a full year. So find an explanation for any of that how you will, because it doesn't really make sense. There's a lot of plot accordions in Supernatural where you kind of have to fudge dates and imagine something took place in a different amount of time than the show states it does, just to make everything fit, because Sarah wanted a full year time gap, but it really doesn't give us a full year. And honestly, I would hate it less, and it would be more believable if it was just 5 months. Our flashback is in sort of gray-toned shots of Stull that look very dramatic. Sam throwing the rings down and diving into the cage, and with a echoey narration of Sam talking about how he's not coming back, and that Dean should go and find Lisa and live that apple pie life. Finishing with, "Promise me, Dean! Promise me!" Like angrily forcing Dean to promise Sam that. And then now, 1 year later, Dean waking up as if that had been his nightmare, dream, what still haunts him. And the tone of the images shifts from that cold gray blue to warm sunshine on Dean's face as he wakes up in bed next to Lisa. And the song that plays is Beautiful Loser by Bob Seger, as we see a montage of what Dean's life is like now. He wakes up at least a full minute before his alarm went off, and he's just lying in bed looking kind of stunned, like he can't come to terms with things. He's just staring at the ceiling with a hand on his head as Lisa rolls over and greets him good morning. She asks if he's okay, and he tells her, "Yeah, I'm good." And it's very clear that he is anything but good. We then see Dean grabbing a salt canister out of the cupboard. Instead of using it to hunt with, he's using it to make breakfast. But we are reminded how he has always used salt in the past, through a montage of, again, gray-toned clips of him dumping rock salt and salt and burning, intercut with him serving up scrambled eggs. We see him open the back of a storage crate in the back of a pickup truck, and it's full of tools, but not the tools that are normally in the Impala, the monster hunting kit underneath the back panel in the trunk. These are like construction tools, and we're reminded of the difference with an intercut scene of the trunk of the Impala. Dean shuts the compartment in the back of his truck, and we're shown a shot of Sam and Dean shutting the trunk in one of those we've got work to do moments. Dean backs out of the driveway in his handy pickup truck, intercut with a shot of Baby backing out. He's working on a construction site, hammering something in, sawing wood, intercut with shots of him staking monsters and beheading a vampire with the same kind of saw. Prying wood with a crowbar versus opening a coffin with a crowbar. Grabbing a couple beers out of a cooler in a backyard barbecue versus grabbing a couple of beers out of the green cooler and handing one to Sam. Almost as if this is what Dean's got running in the back of his head through all of these scenes. That he just can't have it all. He can't have that life back. There's a shot of him teaching Ben how to fix the engine in the truck, and him showing Sam how to fix the engine in the Impala. And in the background of the shot with Ben, you can see the Impala in the garage under a tarp. It's buried away. The end of the night, Dean walks around the inside of the house, finishing a glass of whiskey, checking all the doors are locked and all the windows are locked, and he sees his neighbors across the street through the window. He checks on Ben and then climbs into bed with Lisa, and then the camera pans down underneath the bed. He's still got protective hunting tools there, holy water, weapons. And then we cut to the new title card, a pane of glass shattering, which kind of feels appropriate for how Dean is sort of feeling right now. At the center of the opening shot after the title card is the glowing El Sol sign, and Dean is sitting under a red lamp, the danger warning demon sign. Something is very fishy about everything that happens in this bar, because that's where Dean is, with his neighbor we saw through the window across the street. This all has a deeply rooted feeling of Dean looking slightly displaced. Like, he's going through the motions. He's engaging because that's what he's supposed to do, right? and he's listening to his friend tell a story of his misspent youth, something about a goat that he's glad happened before the age of Facebook and the internet, and says something like, 15 years ago, if you'd told me that this would be my life, suburbia. And Dean's like, oh yeah, don't I know it? And he just looks off to the side like he's remembering all those gray-tinged shots we've gotten to this point. Like, it's not quite real, but it is real to him. And from everything that they set up around it, it's like he misses that life. Like, he's forcing himself to try and fit into this life. And he doesn't really, because he just has to lie about everything. Kind of like Sam at Stanford, except Sam wanted that, chose that, was enthusiastically excited about the opportunity to not have to confess to the reality of his life. He wanted to just fit in and be normal. To Dean, this is torture. Not that he doesn't enjoy this man's company, or he wouldn't continue going to the bar with him for a year. And that's what Sid tells him. It's like, oh, you moved in about a year ago, right? So I've been buying you beer for a year, and I still don't know anything about your life. So Dean is uncomfortable with all of that. And the show just keeps drilling it into our heads. It's been a year. It's been a year. Even though it's been about 5 months. Which still pisses me off, man. But Sid is trying to get stories out of Dean. Like, what did you do up to this point? You know, here he is confessing to his embarrassing moment with a goat. And Dean can't even share a single anecdote about his life on the road. Dean says there's not much to tell about his life. He took crap jobs that nobody else wanted, monster hunting. But he thinks about it for a moment and comes up with pest control. And the thing is, Dean, if somebody tells you, hey, I've had this life where I've just done a lot of crap jobs that nobody else wanted, that sounds interesting. People will ask you about that for the sake of humor or finding compassion for the suffering that you've been through or whatever. People are interested in people's terrible stories. We're just ghouls that way, I guess. Pest control is not inaccurate for what Dean did. Sid jokes that Dean's practically respectable now, working his regular job, and Dean's like, yeah, it's kind of scary. And it is to him. That's a life that he never thought he would have, ever. I mean, when we first met him 5 years ago, he thought that life sounded like the worst thing in the world. They're interrupted by the waitress bringing them the check. The waitress with some pretty interesting tattoos, who touches Dean's arm as she lays the check down for them. Sid comments that she's kind of into Dean, and Dean holds up the check that has her phone number written on it. Dean complains, like, why are women only interested in guys that are taken? Dean just tears the number up, and the two of them leave. Dean crosses the street to his truck, but he's distracted by the sound of somebody screaming in a nearby building. It's like closed and under scaffolding, like it's under construction. He stops at his truck, pockets a weapon, gets a flashlight, and heads into the building, which is plastered with flyers for DJ Sam, a dude in a hoodie, giving the thumbs up like, somebody's playing Sam. What we see is a Dean that has not lost any of his reflexes or instincts for hunting. The way he scopes this building with his gun and his flashlight, and he's completely alert to every sound, though he is frightened by a pigeon. The only thing he ends up finding is a claw mark and a blood-stained handprint smeared nearby. No other evidence that any supernatural activity has taken place in this building. So he goes home and starts calling around, checking on missing persons, checking hospitals to see if anyone's been injured. We hear Dean on the phone with police telling them he just had a hunch that he's been a cop for a long time. And that's when Lisa walks in and Dean averts his eyes like, she'll know that he's working on some sort of hunt-related thing, and he's tried to probably shield her from all of that. He hangs up and then quickly closes out of all the windows he had open on his laptop, looking into this case, And he flat out lies to Lisa as he takes a sip of his whiskey and tells her he was on the phone with Sid setting up a poker game. And she looks at him like, why are you trying to lie to me, Dean? But Lisa doesn't say anything. She just tells him it's 11:30. I was just wondering if everything was okay. And he's like, oh gosh, yeah, like he lost track of time. And tells her that he'll be right up. And she accepts this. Like, she knows Dean's got parts of his life that he's not going to talk to her about, and she's just okay with that. And I want to take a moment here to talk about what a freaking saint Lisa is. That she was so kind to open her home to this guy that she'd known for a grand total of 3 days of her life before, and had a couple of really disturbing encounters with. But she just let him move into her house, become part of her and her son's life, knowing how mentally and emotionally broken he was at the time. He probably spilled everything that had happened or close to it and let him stay. And that's just wild to me. But she was what Dean needed for this 5 months or this year or however long it is in reality that he's been there. And I've sometimes wondered if Lisa and Ben weren't just constructs created by Chuck to make the story interesting, to be Dean's end-of-the-line people that he could go to. Just because they're there for him in ways that nobody else in the story is, even if that all falls apart by mid-season. But just the way that they are removed from the story later on is just so absolutely awful. And the fact that we never hear from them or about them in canon ever again, and we just have to presume that they survived the series and just went on to live normal, happy, well-adjusted lives, forgetting all about monsters and Dean and everything. It's like, to see that whole evolution, knowing where it ends, I try to keep that in mind because it all seems specifically constructed to be a horror for Dean, even though it's a comfort for him now. And not even really a complete comfort, because he's just more afraid for these people than he is, you know, he feels obligated to stay to protect them from the threat that he brings into their life. And isn't that just a Chuck Payne plot point? Dean goes through the same motions that we saw in the cold open, closing the drapes, locking the door, checking that everything is secure with his additional shot of whiskey. Even though he's barefoot now, he's not wearing his heavy boots around the house. So he's achieved a modicum of comfort. But this time he takes an extra step. He checks underneath the front entryway rug and makes sure the devil's trap he has painted underneath is still intact. After his shakeup of an experience at that construction site building, he's not going to take chances. He's going to double check the supernatural protections on his house, not just the locks and the drapes. The next day, Dean's out driving. He's waiting at a stop sign and notices the same scratch marks that he'd seen in that abandoned building on a telephone pole, because it was specifically designed to, because it's all hallucinations due to gin poisoning, and he doesn't even know it. So the El Sol sign at the bar where he was sitting under the red lampshade of danger, he doesn't even realize that he'd been in danger, that he'd been poisoned at that bar by the waitress. There's your El Sol. Gin. It's not just the unreality of his year with Lisa, it's the unreality of the actual supernatural. But Dean being Dean, of course, he pulls over to investigate. He gets his gun, looks at the claw marks, then enters the yard of a house and finds a sheet hanging on the clothesline outside, also with 4 slash marks in it. And just like back at the construction site where he had to pull layers of plastic sheeting away to get from place to place, now he has to pull actual sheets away. He finds a little shed building with 4 more scratch marks on it, gets his gun out, opens the door, and is ready for anything. The look on his face is pure, finally I get to kill something. Except it's not something he needs to kill. It's a Yorkie. Again, how many times has Dean been terrorized by Yorkies in this show? And as Dean's standing there in confusion, as this Yorkie flees the shed and runs away, Sid runs by like he's been out jogging, wearing his little Nirvana t-shirt. And he's like, Dean, were you about to shoot the neighbor's dog? And Dean's like, oh, thought it was a possum. Right, they carry rabies. That's only very mildly true. Most possums are immune to rabies, so. But Sid believes Dean, because, you know, he used to be an exterminator. Just as Dean's finishing up his little explanation of what he's doing, he looks down and notices something else in the doorway of this little shed. Sulfur. He tells Sid he's gotta go and runs off. And Sid's like, what the hell? That was a very weird encounter. Dean immediately goes back home, directly to the Impala's trunk under the tarp in the garage, and starts filling up a duffel bag with weapons because between the claw marks and the sulfur, there is definitely something very bad happening in this neighborhood, and he is going to be prepared, goddammit. But he's interrupted by Lisa, who's like, comes into the garage, says nothing, and Dean rushes to cover up what he's doing in the trunk, hides the Impala back under the tarp again, and pretends like he was there just getting a hammer out of a toolbox. Lisa tells Dean she just ran into Sid, who said Dean almost shot a Yorkie. Is there anything you want to tell me? And Dean has to confess that he's got a sense that something is very wrong. Lisa flat out asks him, are you hunting something? And Dean's like, well, at first I thought I was, but I think I got myself worked up over nothing. He's trying to comfort her with this lie. He's clearly still hunting something. He's terrified. Dean tells her he doesn't want her to be afraid, but he does want her to be safe. He tells her to take Ben and go to the movies, hang out with a big group of people while he does one last sweep to make sure everything's safe. And she agrees. Unlike that first time when Dean was trying to save them from the changelings and he handed them a credit card and told Lisa to just take Ben out of town. And Lisa's like, no, I'm not leaving, you crazy person. Now she's just like, okay, because she knows. She just tells Dean to be careful, kisses him, and then leaves. And then Dean goes to work. He pulls out an old, battered, beat-up looking trunk, pulls out the leather jacket that he used to wear that went missing after this was filmed and was never seen again. It went missing from a photo shoot for the season. That's why we never see it again. He pulls out John's journal, and there's some other stuff in the box, but we don't get to see what any of that was because the light bulb starts flickering, and Dean knows that something has found him. Soccer ball goes bouncing across the other side of the garage. Dean goes to check it out, raises his gun, and there's nothing there. And then he turns around and is face to face with the yellow-eyed demon, who's supposed to be dead because Dean killed him. He says, hiya, Dean. Look what the apocalypse shook loose, as if it had the power to bring back Azazel. And that's something that Dean can believe, and he looks terrified. Azazel takes credit for the little trail he'd left for Dean of all the claw marks. When Dean tries to say, no, you can't be back, Azazel's like, the big daddy brought your pal Cass back, so why couldn't he bring me back too? And here's where it starts sounding like Dean's own fears speaking back to him. Azazel's like, you didn't think you were going to get to keep all of this, this nice little life you've built up for yourself. And how do you keep your lawn so green? Is his first comment after he mentions Cass. Like, what was it? Angelic magic keeping Dean's lawn green? I mean, we know Cass is going to come back and watch Dean rake leaves. Maybe he thinks that good lawn care is important to Dean and helped it along a little bit. I mean, wouldn't that be just hilarious? Anyway, back to this episode. Azazel tells Dean, and this is probably pretty accurate to why the djinn showed up, you had to know the idea that something was going to show up and ruin his life at some point, that he wouldn't get to just live in peace, and Dean knows it, or he wouldn't have kept a devil's trap under his front rug and holy water and a shotgun under his bed. And as Azazel chokes the life out of Dean, he looks into his face and is like, you can't outrun your past. Which is kind of what Dean's been trying to do. Pretend everything's normal. Because that's what Sam made him promise to do. And just as Dean's about to pass out, we see a different shot of Sam plunging a needle into somebody who is clearly Dean and not being held down by Azazel. And then Dean's sitting bolt upright. Sam, not Azazel. Clearly some time has passed when Dean comes to again, lying on a cot in what looks like an abandoned house. Sam took him away from his garage and, I guess for Dean's own protection or whatever, because he had to sleep off whatever the antidote Sam gave him was. But Dean thinks he's now hallucinating or dead, because Sam is also supposed to be in a cage in hell. Sam's like, I was expecting a slightly different reaction, like a hug or holy water in the face, something. And Dean's like, so I'm dead? And Sam's like, no, I saved your life. Dean is still confused. And he's like, well, are you real? And Sam's like, oh yeah, I'm real. Here, let me save you the trouble. He whips out a knife, without hesitation, just cuts his own arm. Then pours some salt into a jug of holy water and has a chug. Nothing happens. Dean slowly walks over to Sam and then just pulls him into a hug. Relieved, he cannot believe his brother is out of hell. Dean's first question is, well, how the hell did you get out? Was it God or Cass? Does Cass know anything about it? And Sam's like, I don't know, you tell me. I was in hell and then I wasn't. And apparently Cass is not answering any of his prayers. Sam tells Dean that he looked for what pulled him out of hell. For weeks he looked. Dean's like, weeks? How long have you been back? Why didn't you come get me right away? And Sam tells him, oh, I've been back for a year. And Sam doesn't look the least disturbed about telling Dean this. The look on Jared's face is just acting. Because it comes off so creepy when you know what's really going on. And I appreciate that. And Dean is righteously and 100% correctly furious with Sam. You've been back a whole year and you couldn't even send a text. Like, let me know you're not suffering eternal torment in hell. That would have been really nice to know, Sam. Sam very confidently and calmly says, you finally had what you wanted, Dean. I didn't want to take that away from you. Dean's like, I wanted my brother alive. And Sam authoritatively tells Dean, you wanted a family. You have for a really long time. And you had one here. And Dean's looking at Sam like he's just grown an extra head. Like, when have I ever wanted a family? Sam's like, oh, I know you. I know you've always wanted this. And it's like, have you been paying attention at all, Sam? Sam's like, protecting the promise that he forced Dean to make. Because that's the life that Sam always wanted. Life in suburbia, white picket fence, wife who he has to keep all these secrets from, doesn't really fit in, but Sam would have been perfectly happy to accept that, to trade with Dean there. Dean is just too horrified to even look at Sam, and Sam is still trying to justify his choices and actions. He's like, it just seemed like after everything, you deserve to have some normal life. Dean just can't even address that right now. It's too awful a thing for him to even contemplate yet, so he turns it back on Sam. What have you been doing for this year? Sam tells Dean that he's hooked up with some other hunters, more like family, and he brings Dean out to meet the Campbell hunters, starting with Samuel, who's also mysteriously back from the dead. This is a dude that died in 1973. Suddenly just back alive. Kind of makes you wonder if all the other Campbells that are back alive actually existed before this, since this is the first we've ever heard of any of them. And after Dean is introduced to all of them, Dean brings up the same point. I thought all Mom's relatives were gone. How come we never heard of any of you? And that's when Samuel walks in and tells Dean, because they didn't know about you. It took Samuel bringing them all together. We get a little montage of who the heck Samuel was, their grandfather, and how he died the night Mary made her deal with Azazel. Dean is now doubly concerned because Sam and Samuel are both resurrected. Samuel suggests that whatever pulled Sam up pulled me down, wanted both of them alive. And I think it's very funny that Samuel thinks he was in heaven. How much tinkering did Crowley have to do with his brain to make him think he'd been in heaven all this time? Because we know Crowley is the one who pulled him off the bench and put him back in the game. And I don't think Crowley has that kind of access in heaven. And Dean is distressed by all of this. Am I the only one who thinks this all just can't be fine? Like, you two come back from the dead and you don't think this is an emergency situation? Samuel's like, oh, I wanted to come get you, but Sam insisted we keep you out of it. And it's funny because we'll find out later that Cass really wanted to keep Dean out of things. He didn't want to drag Dean back into heaven's business. And it's like, it directly affects him. How can you not? It's just so disturbing that nobody would bother Dean because of this stupid, dumbass promise he made Sam. Cass and Sam were both trying to force Dean to honor a promise that should have been negated by the abject, batshit wackiness of their situations. Like, we'll get to that in a minute here. I will properly tirade on that once we get through this scene. Samuel explains, but now we're here because you were poisoned. I was poisoned by them a few days ago. It's gin, a new strain of gin, apparently, that can blend in with people and with just a touch poison you to relive your worst nightmares. So what we saw with Dean with Azazel, that was his worst nightmare. Dean asks Sam how he's still breathing if you OD from a few days worth of this gin poison in your blood. It's because Samuel had a cure for gin poison. Dean is kind of shocked by this. Samuel's like, I know things. I know things your daddy didn't even dream of. And it kind of makes me wonder how much of Samuel's knowledge was enhanced by Crowley resurrecting him. He needed Samuel to be in this position. He needed Samuel to be capable of rounding up all of his alpha monsters. So he needed Samuel to be armed and prepared to deal with all the alpha monsters. And it kind of makes me think that the Campbell family library may have been enriched by a generous donation from the Fergus MacLeod Charitable Foundation. The Campbells had apparently been tracking these djinn for a while, and when the djinn targeted Sam, they all assumed that Dean would be their next target. And that's why they were in town, hoping to get the djinn before they got Dean. It's basically using Dean as bait. Dean immediately panics. Lisa and Ben, they're at the house right now. And Samuel assures him he's got people watching the house, which is very thoughtful of him. But, sadly, ineffective. Dean demands to be taken home immediately. Sam speeds into their driveway. Their front door is already open. Dean calls out for Lisa and Ben. And Sam notices the lookout that Samuel had sent to keep an eye on the house is sitting in his car across the street, dead. Dean rushes to the kitchen, panics, tries to call Lisa. As he looks over photos of the family that they've taken over the last year, pinned to the corkboard above the phone, when Lisa walks in and she's like, hey, where have you been? Dean immediately grabs her up in a hug, like, thank God you're okay. Where's Ben? Lisa and Ben are kind of confused. Dean orders them to go upstairs and pack a bag because we're going to a friend's house. Lisa tries to be reassuring to Ben, and when Ben turns to leave, Sam walks in, shocking both Ben and Lisa, who do recognize Sam, but thought he was dead. Of course, the old friend that Dean is taking them to stay with is Bobby. When Bobby opens the door and sees Dean, his face falls and he's like, damn it. Like, if you're here, then something really terrible has happened because we've tried to keep you out of this for a year. This is the first time that Bobby's ever met Lisa and Ben. It's like Dean's worlds are colliding here. As Bobby tells Lisa and Ben to go upstairs and make themselves at home and warns them of the dangerous decor, Sam strolls in and Bobby realizes that all the beans have been spilled. Dean looked as if he was about to surprise Bobby with Sam's resurrection, but Sam's just like, hey, Bobby. Bobby's just like, Sam. Bobby knew that Sam had been alive this whole time, and it was one thing for Sam to try and keep it from Dean that he was alive again, but Dean cannot figure out why Bobby would have kept this from him. They have a big family discussion about it. Dean just feels betrayed. Bobby doubles down. He's like, I'd do it again, even though he's got his arms folded, all defensive. And Dean's like, why? Why would you torment me like that again? And Bobby is like, because you got out, Dean. You got that life that was stolen from me, that Sam always wanted for himself. You got what we always wanted. But Dean comes right back. He's like, do you have any clue what that meant? Bobby's like, yeah, it meant a woman and a kid and not getting your guts ripped out at age 30. And isn't that exactly what happened to Dean when his hellhound deal came due right around age 30? Yeah. Moving on, though. Dean's like, I went to them, very accusatorily pointing at Sam, because you told me to. And Bobby's like, good. And Dean's like, good for who? I showed up at their door completely out of my mind. I drank too much. I was a horrible housemate to these people, and they took me in. I was just out of my mind with grief. I looked everywhere. I collected hundreds of books trying to find a way to get you out of hell. And Sam's just like, very stone-faced about this. You promised you'd leave it alone. And Dean's like, of course I didn't leave it alone. What are you, a moron, Sam? Did you actually think that he wouldn't try to get you out? That he would live up to that promise? The part of his promise that he could keep was staying with Lisa and staying away from hunting. That was the only promise that he could keep to you. So he did, even though it tormented all three of them for a year. The phrase Dean uses here is, you couldn't even put me out of my misery. And Bobby's like, look, I knew it was tough for you, but it's as close to happiness as I've ever seen a hunter get. Not that it was happiness, but it's as close to. It was a simulation of happiness. Bobby's heartbroken in part because Dean was out. Dean's like, do I look out to you? And Bobby's like, yeah, I know. But they had to try. Sam had convinced him that that was the best thing they could do for Dean. And Sam just stares up at Dean unrepentantly. He wouldn't undo that because we know Sam has no soul here. Dean doesn't know it yet. Right now, it just seems like Sam's being an ass. Lisa comes down the stairs and as Dean storms out of the room and Dean's like, Bobby's great. He'll look after you for a couple of days and because me and Sam are going to go out. And Lisa sits down on the stairs like, for how long? Because remember, she's just had her entire life uprooted overnight because some weird monster came hunting for Dean. You know, they could have just removed Dean from the situation and Lisa and Ben probably would have eventually been fine, but no. Dean's now responsible, and now the monsters are going to use Lisa and Ben as a weapon against Dean if he's their target, you know? Dean is just feeling miserable about having made Lisa and Ben into targets for monsters by having gone to them in the first place, which is just doubling over his anger towards Sam and Bobby for not telling him anything for a year, going all the way back to that dumbass promise that he made Sam. Dean tries to apologize to Lisa. He's like, those things are coming for me, and I should have known. You know, it's my fault you're in danger. And Lisa's like, how could you have known? And Dean just says, I should have known. Something always comes for him eventually. And this is clearly something that Dean has been fearing for a while. I was stupid and reckless, and he looks down before saying, you can't outrun your past. Which is what Azazel told him in his gin poison vision. Apparently these gin bring up your worst nightmares, your worst fears. Well, that's his. That something terrible would come for Lisa and Ben because he couldn't outrun his past. Because he never really left it. Lisa lets that process through for a minute. And she's like, you're saying goodbye. And Dean sits down beside her on the stairs and tells her, I'm saying I'm sorry. Sorry that I came into your life and brought you this sort of misery. And Lisa tells him he's an idiot without hesitating. Is like, I know it wasn't greeting card perfect, but we had a good thing. Dean's like, I was a wreck half the time. How could you even say that? And Lisa just doubles down. Well, the guy who just saved the world shows up at your door. You expect him to have a few problems. It's like, holy shit, woman, you are sent by heaven, like, to console him and keep him distracted and occupied or something? What? And I kind of feel bad for Lisa here. She tells Dean that he's always been great with Ben, like a dad to him. Then tells Dean, you don't think it was great, but it was the best year of my life. And that makes me worry that, man, she has lived some sort of really tragic, horrific life. If 12 years of raising Ben before Dean came back into her life, or I guess 9 years of raising Ben before Dean came back into her life, he's like 12 now. Whatever. All of that was just terrible comparatively to the year that she spent with the guy with grief and nightmares and a drinking problem came into her house. And sure, Dean's been great with Ben that we saw in the cold open, but like the best year of her life. Dean's like half present and like constantly staring off into space in all the earlier scenes before the djinn attacked. Like his mind is always on two things at once. And that will become a growing problem for both Sam and Dean over the course of the series, right through to the very end. You ever think about something with someone, you know, in the life who understands? Wouldn't it be great to have, like, a relationship that works with hunting? And you don't have to pack up half of who you are as a person in order to have a relationship, or pack your normal life away in order to go hunting. Like, is there a balance where we can balance these two sides of this problem? At the end of the series, neither of them achieves balance. Sam ends up with a blurry wife where his life is entirely erased to that point, and he just sits out in the Impala and cries in a garage and wears a bad wig. And Dean just dies. Like, they can never find that balance and peace and both worlds. They have to be one or the other, or it just destroys them, according to the series finale and literally no other episode in the entire series leading up to it. So, take that as you will. But that's the problem that Dean is really facing here for the first time. And, I mean, he didn't even want that apple pie life, really. It was just nice to keep it in the back of his mind as like a nice fantasy daydream. It wasn't like Sam, who like fought to get that and build that for himself, ran away to college, tried to pretend the rest of his life never existed, and thought he was happier that way. Not Dean. And I know Sam is soulless here and can't understand why Dean would be angry about any of this, or why Dean wouldn't have wanted that life for himself, and why Dean is happier hunting, and goddamn, Sam should have just knocked on his door that very first night. Even if he lost his chance to be with Lisa, it would have saved them all these problems. I can forgive Sam's soullessness as to why he let this happen, but I cannot forgive Sam with his soul who forced Dean to make that promise before he jumped in the pit, before he said yes to Lucifer. That Sam is responsible for all of this. Sam brings Dean back to the Campbell compound. Dean's like, okay, what's the plan? He realizes they don't really have a plan. They're baiting and drawing out the djinn. And Dean's like, so how about we just go kill them? And Christian's like, oh, yeah, like, leave this to the professionals. You don't know how hard it is to draw out djinn, yeah. Dean's like, these djinn clearly want me and Sam. They know where I live. I think it's probably a fair bet that if we go there, the djinn will come after us there. It's almost like I'm a professional. Dean's already let it go a couple of times when Gwen made the remark earlier about, oh, you've got delicate features for a hunter. It's like, you're like half his size, Gwen, and a pretty dainty girl, too, even if you are a hunter. So you're criticizing Dean for being attractive? That's kind of creepy and weird. We know how hunters can posture at one another over their prowess at hunting and whatever. They didn't know him at all, and it seemed more like slightly friendly teasing. But Christian here was just challenging Dean's competence as a hunter. Like, you don't know what you're doing. You've gone soft. You're out of the game. The smiles that Christian, Gwen, and Samuel give are almost like, that's what we expected. Almost like it's a little test for Dean, because they don't know him and how he hunts. And yet, they knew that that's why they were in town in the first place, was because they assumed that Dean would be the djinn's next target. And were just camping out, waiting for the djinn to attack, to draw them out. And here's Dean volunteering to be bait again, almost like the Campbells wanted him to volunteer to be bait and didn't want to have to suggest it to him and have him go, oh, hell no, I'm not being bait. Or even just to prove that he knew that he needed to be bait. Either way, any of those ways, it amounts to about the same. As we're parked out front of Dean and Lisa's house, it's interesting to note that this is now the third, I think, different house we've seen Lisa living in. This woman really moves a lot, and they're going to move again at the end of next episode. So as they set up, Gwen picks up an InStyle magazine and taunts Dean about it, like, oh, here's a real good one. And Dean just rolls his eyes like, yeah, I have a girlfriend. She reads fashion magazines. So what? Other members of the group are picking up like framed photos of Dean and his family. And Dean's like, hey, don't touch that. Keep your huntery mitts off my suburban family photo. But it's Sam who finds golf clubs underneath the front stairs. Like, Sam, first of all, what are you doing in the closet under the stairs? And second of all, they put the golf clubs in there because in real life, Jensen, I don't know if you saw his tweet that was technically today, but by the time you all hear this, it's going to be a couple weeks ago, where he's of himself with a golfer, some professional golfer, I think, but I don't know from professional golfers. But Jensen's super into golf, and they were just trying to incorporate that into the show just to poke fun at Jensen. Dean's in the kitchen splashing water on his face when Samuel comes in and tells Dean, you've got a really nice house. Dean's like, yeah, whatever, you're going to tease me too, call me a soccer mom. Samuel's like, I don't even know what that is. And he tells Dean, I get it, you wanted a normal life. Your mom wanted a normal life too. And Dean's looking at Samuel like, when did I ever say I wanted a normal life? Samuel asks Dean if Sam told him what they had been dealing with over the last few months. It's not just a few uppity djinn. All sorts of monsters have been acting up. Nocturnal creatures are attacking in broad daylight. Werewolves are attacking outside of the full moon. Creatures are just behaving abnormally. And they have no idea why. We will later find out that, yeah, Samuel has way more idea of what's causing the chaos, including his own activities that have stirred it up. on behalf of his boss, Crowley. So we know that a lot of this is just flat out lies, misdirection, and that Sam knows a little bit, but not everything, and is just cool as a cucumber lying about it because he has no soul. So it's fascinating to me to watch all of that unfold as the season goes on, knowing how it all comes out. And so I just like to give those reminders. Well, this is why they're saying these things here and why we know it's a lie and why it still works. Sarah Gamble wanted this season to be noir, and she drove so far into it, she forgot that the rest of us need to at least know what the plot is. Like, you gotta leave us a thread to follow through the dark here, lady. I really enjoy her writing on an individual episode level, but please do not let her craft whole stories. That's all I ask. Even though Kripke helped craft this storyline, this entire plot arc, it's like neither of them knew where it was going to end, except in broad strokes, and didn't have any control over how it all unfolded. And those beats should have been etched out before they started. This season could have been so interesting, and it's like they kept finding new bouncy balls to follow and chase around, and forgot about the other ones. But we'll complain about that as the season goes on. But Samuel is here to appeal to Dean, hunter to hunter, family to family, that it's your heritage and you should be helping us because we're out here fighting and dying, trying to get out ahead of whatever is stirring up this nonsense. And we really could use you joining the team. And it's like, well, if you really thought Dean could be useful to the team before now, how come you didn't insist on bringing him back in, even over Sam's objections? Although I do understand why Samuel is taking full advantage of trying to get Dean on board Team Campbell now that he has access. Dean goes outside to where another Campbell is sitting out in their van, surveilling the neighborhood with a scope. And Dean's like, oh, you see anything? 3 Jin out in the trees, just watching the house. And Dean goes back in the house and tells everybody, look, they're just sitting out there. They're not going to come in here when you're all in here armed and camped out. They're going to wait until I'm alone, and then they're going to come get me. You've got to pull back like you're leaving. Sam agrees with Dean and convinces Samuel and the rest of the Campbells to pack up and move out. They're not going far, but they're going far enough that the Jin think they're gone. This awkwardly leaves Sam and Dean alone for the first time, really, all episode, since they've had a chance to process all of this through. Sam asks Dean if he's doing all right, and Dean's like, that's like the stupidest question I've ever heard. Of course not. Dean turns it around on Sam. Like, isn't all this just insane? You and Grandpa both back from the dead and you have no idea how. Even though this is territory we've already covered, that no, Sam doesn't know how he got out of hell. Dean asks Sam if he remembers it, if he remembers the cage. Sam's like, yeah. And Dean's like, do you want to talk about it? Because Dean's been to hell as well. It's not like it's anything that he doesn't have to explain. Because you remember when Dean came back from hell and Sam was like, well, talk to me about it. And Dean's like, I could never make you understand. Well, they have this in common now. Dean would understand. But Sam refuses. I just want to be grateful that I'm out. I'm back. I can breathe fresh air and see my family and hug you again. It's like, well, dude, if that was really the most important thing to you, why didn't you do it the day you got back? So it's slightly off. Everything is just slightly off to Dean, but he really can't put his finger on why he feels that way. Sam's like, why exactly would I want to think about hell? And Dean's like, it's not that you'd want to, it's that you can't stop yourself from thinking about it. But Sam apparently can just shut it off like a switch. Dean is about to say something else in response to that. You really think that, like, Maybe he was going to say, you really think you can just turn it off and not think about it, to try and push Sam into being more open here, when he is distracted by the sight of his two neighbors, the man who he was out for drinks with, Sid, and his wife, collapsing in spasms in their home. The djinn have poisoned and killed his friends. Dean immediately grabs two syringes full of djinn antidote, runs like he's going to cross the street, and Sam tries to stop him. He's like, they're already dead and you know it. And Dean's like, this is happening because of me. I have to at least try to save them. More deaths on Dean's conscience for his selfishness at having kept up this lie for a year because of Sam. And yet Sam is avidly trying to stop Dean from risking himself to try and save these people, which feels very anti-Sam to me. Sam runs into the other room to grab a couple more syringes out of his own bag, turns around to find a djinn right behind him inside Dean's house, and his tattoos extend magically down his arm, and Sam knows he's in trouble. While Dean is attempting to revive Sid, he's grabbed from behind, and the waitress from the restaurant, from the very beginning of the episode, the tattoo on her upper arm extends down her arm, and she's angry at Dean for having survived the last dose of poison she gave him, so she's going to give him a mega dose, she says as she crushes the syringe of antidote. Meanwhile, Sam is fighting valiantly against his own djinn with a lamp, just clubbing him to death with a lamp, trying to prevent that djinn from touching him and poisoning him again. As Dean takes a mega dose of poison, not just from the waitress lady, but from the guy behind him, also filling him with poison. You can see the little black veins appearing on his face around where their hands are holding him. When Sam loses his lamp in the fight, he dashes over to the closet, grabs a golf club, and uses that to club the djinn. He gets the guy unconscious just in time for the other two djinn to show up, because Dean is completely succumbed to djinn venom. Dean believes that he's in his house dragging his drugged body through his house, and he thinks he sees Lisa and Ben showing up. And the yellow-eyed demon appears again beside Dean, whispering, I'm going to do terrible things. Dean passes out and opens his eyes, and he's lying on Ben's bed all of a sudden. Obviously just a hallucination. But he sees Ben come in with Azazel, and Lisa in a white nightgown getting flung and pinned to the wall, while Azazel is super creepy to Ben. Like, oh yes, you're going to be one of my children, aren't you? He watches Lisa slide up the wall as Ben willingly drinks the demon's blood. Basically, it's exactly what happened to Sam as a baby, is Dean's worst nightmare. Mother dying on the ceiling, brother lost to a demon. There you go. And Lisa, pinned to the ceiling, now bleeding from her stomach, looks down at Dean and tells him, "This is all your fault," and then bursts into flames. And Dean has to watch it and suffer through it all again. Even if none of it's really happening and he's still passed out from djinn poison on his neighbor's floor. Sam manages to hold off the two djinn just long enough for Samuel to arrive. Samuel stabs one djinn, tells Sam to go help Dean, that he's got her, and slowly begins closing in on the waitress djinn. She starts backing away, but she grows her tattoos down like she's getting prepared to poison him too, when somebody sneaks up behind her and drops a bag over her head and ties her arms together and is wearing gloves so they cannot be poisoned by her. And it's like, what the hell is going on? Since when do they plop bags over the heads of monsters they're going to kill? Because they're not going to kill her. Samuel tells them to get her into the van before the boys come back. They're kidnapping her For what nefarious purpose? I mean, we all know what nefarious purpose, but you don't know when you're watching it for the first time. And this could have been the entire plot of season 6, and it would have worked great as a season-long arc leading up to the big bad reveal of what could have been just the mother of all as the big bad. But no, they had to start panicking and thinking, oh, we got to introduce more plot elements, and we've got Heaven to deal with, and it just became too many things for one season. And it's a shame, because all of these are interesting ideas on their own, but it's like they couldn't decide which story to tell and just tried to tell all of them. The next morning, after Dean has recovered from his poisoning and Samuel and the cousins have apparently already taken off, Sam asks if Dean is coming with. And Dean turns around and he's like, no. And Sam is genuinely surprised. His eyebrows make it like halfway to his hairline. And Dean's like, I know, I changed my mind. Because I was in their life, they've become targets. It's not fair to them to just pick up and leave them unprotected. And isn't that exactly what John spent his entire life raising these two to be? Like, I couldn't let them out of my sight because I'd made them unsafe. Like, I have to keep them safe by putting them in danger again and again, continuously dragging them around the country on hunts because it's my fault that they were in danger in the first place and I'm responsible for their safety. And it's the worst. And Dean will eventually come to that realization, trying to stay with Lisa. This is the most like my father I've ever been, and I was always terrified that I would turn into him, and I am turning into him by doing exactly what he did to me and Sam, to you and Ben. So Dean does get to learn that lesson of how easy it is to become that obsessed bastard. And I think that gives him a lot of sympathy for John's plight, even if he's still bitter about it and pissed off about how he was raised, because at least Dean was self-aware enough to see that happening and step back and remove himself from that circumstance and realize and change and consciously not become that. Then again, Dean had John as a do not be this man banner hanging in the front of his brain his whole life. And John didn't have that sort of banner, you know? So Dean's got an advantage on John there and didn't become him. Thank God. And here's Sam, especially for a soulless dude, being remarkably self-aware, telling Dean, I practically shoved you at them and made you go to them, and it's my fault that you were ever here in the first place. I legitimately thought you would be happy here. And the phrase that Sam uses is interesting. I wanted that for you. Not, I knew you wanted that. I wanted that for you. Like, what Dean wanted didn't matter to Sam in that moment. And he acknowledges that here. But now Sam's not so sure that Dean can have that life. And acknowledges that going back to them now might be putting them in further danger. And Dean's like, what? So I'm just supposed to walk away and leave them completely unprotected? No, I can't. I did this to them. I made them vulnerable the moment I knocked on their door. And I can't undo that. I think he a little bit at least blames Sam, because he wouldn't have gone and knocked on their door when Sam was gone. He would have stayed with Bobby. He would not have put them in this position if Sam hadn't pushed him to. Dean feels like he's between a rock and a hard place here. He can't unring the bell and put the monsters back in the bag, and he just can't walk away with a clean conscience. Sam accepts that. He's like, I understand. I just wish you were coming is all. Dean looks at him like, why the hell would you want that? I did something stupid hunting. You know plenty of better hunters than me who, you know, I'm clearly rusty. I did something stupid and almost got both of us killed trying to save the neighbor. And Sam looks at Dean like he's insane. He's like, that's exactly why I want you to come. because you didn't hesitate. You just went because you care. That's who you are. And that's a very prescient observation from a guy with no soul again. Dean's just like, what the hell? You care too. You would have done the same thing. And Sam's like, no, I wouldn't have. And Dean cannot process that. He's like, the Sam I knew would have definitely tried to save random innocent people. This is not processing for Dean. He's like, this is not the Sam I remember. What the hell? As one final gesture, as Sam is getting ready to leave, Dean offers Sam the Impala, holds up the keys, and is like, she should be hunting. And Sam processes this for a moment. I can't even say thinks about it, because it's like he's calculating what the correct answer should be to this, and decides no. And his excuse is, I've got my car set up the way I like it. Which is a weird thing to say when someone's offering you your childhood home and your personal lifetime of experience living in it. Like, dude, something is seriously wrong with Sam, and it's so obvious in retrospect. Dean walks Sam out. The only thing Sam can say is, it was really good to see you again, Dean, and then just turns like a robot and walks away. And Dean is just left there to puzzle over what felt so off about his brother. Like, what else is he hiding? Because Sam is clearly hiding stuff from him. And Dean has no idea what. He doesn't know who to trust or what the hell is actually going on. And he knows there's a bigger picture that he needs to start breaking down. But he just feels like he can't be part of any of it. I think he's pissed at Bobby for not coming clean with him. He's pissed at Sam for not coming clean with him. He's pissed at the entire Campbell family, who knew that he would probably like to know that Sam's alive and that they're all hunting together again. And none of them stepped forward and said, hey, this is the deal. They let it get to the point where his family had to be endangered for them to do anything about it. And then the entire act of the entire previous year, or 5 months, however you look at the timeline. And I'm a lot less pissed off at the notion of Bobby and Sam and everybody else keeping this from Dean for 5 months than I am at them for keeping it for a year. I wish they had just gone with 5 months. That there's nothing wrong with Dean having spent 5 months at Lisa's, but the insistence that it had to be a year because Sarah wanted to put some distance between her show and Kripke era show is just dumb and falls apart right there for me. So I got real nitpicky on season 6. The one thing I do appreciate about it is it's very clear that Sarah Gamble is a Dean girl and is here for flogging Dean with feelings, because golly, that's good to do, and turning Sam into a useless robot who's just there to push the plot forward, and unfortunately also relegating Cass to the role of ultimate villain of the season so she can punish him and kill him for it next season. And isn't that great? And it's not great. It's really not great. It's terrible, in fact. And I hate it. But again, there are redeeming points to this season, and I will go through them with a fine-tooth comb and pick them out and examine them like angsty little nuggets of Dean girlishness, because I'm filled with them. Anyway, thank you to everybody who put up with my short little hiatus. Next week, we'll be talking about season 6, episode 2, Two and a Half Men, where Dean gets dragged right back into hunting because apparently Sam has lost all competence and needs Dean, despite having poked some fun at him for being kind of out of shape hunting this week. But we'll complain about that next week. Until then, you can find me on Tumblr at MittensMorgul or at SPN George, or on Discord at Mittens #4865. And this would be a great time to join the Discord server because, again, if you're a Dean girl and you like to wail about Dean, so do I. There's going to be a lot of it. Or you can email me at mittensmorgel@gmail.com. And I look forward to talking to everybody again real soon. And yeah, I honestly have no idea how long the hiatus is going to be for me here. Maybe it'll only be a week. Maybe it'll be 2 or 3 weeks. I just released the previous episode, and it's like 3 days later, and or 2 days later. The only reason I put the thing on hiatus was because it was a good stopping point between showrunners. Not even just a season end, but a showrunner end. Like, yeah, doesn't get more stopping pointy than this in the whole series. I was like, well, if I have to break, I'd rather break now than in 2 episodes when I don't know how long I'm going to have to stop for. So when I have to go, though, I'm going to have to, like, pack a suitcase and leave my house for, like, probably a couple weeks. So I'm not looking forward to that. You know how sometimes you have a family obligation and it just the sort of thing you just don't want to do. It's a lot of work and it's just exhausting. But, you know, stuff got to get done, even if it's terrible stuff. So thank you all for bearing with me and my time of extreme confusion about all of this. And I hope future us will have many wonderful conversations about it all. But until then, it is what it is. Have a good one, everyone.